Just a second, then, tonight's speakers, Dudley.
Thanks, I'm Dudley, I'm an addict. Can you hear me? Yeah, I was thinking, coming in on the tube, that anybody who is younger than 34 or 33, I've been clean all your life. N.A. works. It's astonishing to... It's strange, but you go to an N.A. meeting, you sit up in the front, and at first everybody looks like strangers, and you look around the room, you begin to meet each other's eyes, and begin to meet people's eyes. Everybody becomes friends. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary. When you first walk in, and then everybody, it just sort of relaxes. And you become, I'm amongst friends. So there's no need for me to be frightened of talking to as many friends. That's a privilege, it's very nice. It centres me in my journey in recovery, which is, you know, has been going on a long time now. Briefly, I had two lives before I came in here. First was masqueraded as an Irish alcoholic in the 60s. Then in the 70s, I masqueraded as a hippie. And then the masquerade finished. But I was in the Mother Fellowship for in and out, looking for an answer, which through no fault of the Mother Fellowship I couldn't find, for on and off 12 years, I think. I was working in the States, I was in Miami Beach, Florida, in a really shit hotel. And I was staying there, I wasn't working there. And my ex old lady had just left and taken the children back. And I knew the game was up, A, because she'd been having an affair with a bloke, and two, because she'd changed her hairstyle and her way of looking without asking me. And I just knew the game was up. I'd had many dramatic disasters throughout my using. I never got done in jail, but I did a lot of time in police cells. And I had, you know, dangerous things, car crashes and stuff like that, all sorts of very dramatic things, and nothing affected me at all. What finally affected me was boredom. I was sitting in this crap hotel room with, you know, those thin carpets with chewing gum and God knows what else on the floor, with a bag of all sorts of gear in my pocket, you know, and in a usual state of paranoia because of the Miami in those days was the drug capital of America. It was also the most vicious police force. And I just got fed up. I can't explain it. I'm not a very religious sort of person, but I went down on my knees in a shitty carpet and asked for help. And they knew in the amongst the people I was working with that I had been trying to get well around in the Mother Fellowship, and so they knew that. They didn't know much else about me. But one of the people in the company I was working with was trying to chat up a girl who worked in the pool bar, and he figured if he got her pissed, she could get his leg over. And she kept refusing to have a drink, and eventually she told him that she was an addict, and he said, well, there's a bloke with us that's got a problem. So, I mean, this is the time when I was praying. He was, I met you about that same evening. So I got a call, and she took me to a meeting in downtown Miami called the Young People's Group of AA. And I was 40-odd. I thought of myself as young. And the great thing about it was that I never heard, because you didn't hear this in England, that so many people in that room, in fact, I think most of them in that room, described themselves as alcoholics and addicts. And addicts, alcoholics. And that was extraordinary for me, because it filled me with two great feelings. One was of tremendous relief, and the other was of kind of excitement, because I had found myself out and I knew that the game was up, and I was absolutely thrilled that the game was up. And it was also clouded in this kind of hip idea that I was a drug addict, man. And a really heavy dude, you know, which is very important for me to be cool and to, and all that kind of stuff, as you can tell. And so I got hold of all this gear that I got, sort of mixture stuff, and flushed it down the loo. And American loos are very narrow, and they're kind of vacuum things. And I just had this vision that this fucking baggie, these bags were going to be caught in the pipe, and they were going to call the police, and the game was up, and I was going to be swagged away for 99 years and one dark day, whatever it was that you get. And it didn't happen. What happened is that this really swish van turned up the next night with fisheye windows and a whiplash aerial full of great sounds coming out of it, and a lot of people in it. And they welcomed me in, and off we went. And they said, do you know where we're going? I said, no. They said, we're going to an NA meeting. I said, what's that? They said, it's Narcotics Anonymous. So I remember we were going past the Bee Gees house then. This was so hip, you know. It was cool. And we went to this little clubhouse that doesn't exist anymore in downtown Miami. And I walked into the room, and there were maybe 20 people there, and I felt at home. I still can't explain it, but I felt at home for the first time in my life. I didn't know anybody, but I just felt at home. I felt recognized. I thought that nobody knew how I felt. I really believed that nobody knew what was going on inside me, or ever would know. I didn't really know. I certainly couldn't explain it. But I knew by the look I was getting from these people that they did know. And in those days, there were no recovery texts. There were just a few pamphlets and a tiny little white book. And the pamphlet's on the table, and I opened one of the pamphlets, and I burst into tears. It described me. In print, black and white. There it was, written down. And expressions that I've remembered ever since and still love to hear when they're first read out, like the therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without parallel. That's sublime for me. That's one of the most important sentences I've ever read, and also one of the most moving. It's incredible. It's very profound and gentle and kind. The therapeutic value of one addict helping another is without, not some fucking government department that can make charts about subtext so they can prove to the minister. Not some, and I've experienced this, expensive Harley Street doctors that talk shit at you and charge you a lot of money. Because I'd been around looking for an answer for a long time, and I looked in a lot of places. And here was this statement. And it had such dignity and decency about it. I was very concerned because I used a whole range of drugs, and different drugs over different periods of time become fashionable and go out of the fashion. And at one time you had to be a specific kind of user. Well, that's what it felt like. And when it says, We're not interested in what you used or how much. That was great for me, because I feel inadequate about everything, so I'm certainly going to be inadequate as an addict. I'm not going to be good enough here when I'm not good enough anywhere else. NA looks after me. NA has got me covered. I can't con NA, I can con myself. NA has got me covered. Every which way I turn, every attempt I make to duck and dive, it's there, and the answer's always there, and it's there in a kind way, in a caring way, in a loving way. It's not threatening, it's not bullying, it's not being a smart ass, it's not trying to be more clever. It's just us sharing our experience, strength and hope, and helping each other to stay alive. And we're looking around the room tonight. I mean, I said to Shelley earlier, I said, listen to the chatter. This doesn't sound like a bunch of drug addicts. This sounds optimistic. It sounds cheerful. It sounds funny. It sounds fun and lively. It doesn't sound like a bunch of junkies. You know, Eloise's family was soon as she was gay for the junkie. I love that. I'm not sure what it says about being gay, but there you are. I know Eloise, and she's a splendid example of what can happen in recovery. I watched her service and the energy she puts into it. I was around when NA began in London, and we were all angry. I think there were about 7 or 8 of us raging. And we'd been looking for the answer down the road. And I was told in Miami, when you go back to England, go around the Mother Fellowship, as you've been doing, and describe yourself as an alcoholic and an addict, and tell them that you're clean through the good grace of Narcotics Anonymous, and see what they say. And they said, this is extraordinary. They said, we've known you actually help other people and have never been able to help yourself over the last 10, 12 years. Now we know the answer, tell us about it. They didn't say, fuck off out of here, as I expected them to say. They didn't say that at all. And so a year later, to the day, a guy came in, an Irishman, a drunk, an alcoholic, and he came into the cafe where we used to sit, and he pretended to be angry, and he said, I'm sick of hearing you cons talking about drugs. And he threw the pamphlet down on the table. He said, there's a starter pack for NA from Frankfurt in Germany. Why don't you start your own meeting? There's a room down the hall, negotiable rent, £3 a week. So we did, and we went into that room the next Thursday. Thursday was my recovery day for 5 years at least. I was rigid that I went to that Thursday meeting. And we didn't know what to do. We just sat there. Mainly we wanted to kill each other. We were so full of anger. I was very bad at needing to be right. It's such an attractive thing, that, isn't it? Needing to be right. I love it. You know. I had to be right, and I had to score points all the time. Somebody once attacked me with a plumber's hammer. She was so angry. She said, I was trying to score a fucking point, and I got the message. I did it. I really did get them. I went home and I thought, what does he mean? What does he mean? And I thought about it. I thought, yeah, I do always have to be right. I'm a pain in the arse. You must drive everybody crackers. No wonder they're angry. Maybe they weren't all angry. I know I was. And there was a couple of people who wanted to kill me. But again, the robustness and the extraordinary ability of the program. Because I think what we did learn in early London NA is that NA is an addict. The fellowship is an addict. The fellowship has to do its steps. It has to grow. It has to learn. It's exactly the same as an individual. and this is what happened with us. And when we got into jams, we always went to the traditions. And without being pompous, I've always been a great reader of politics and philosophy and stuff. I'm not very intellectual, but I'm a great reader. And I believe that the traditions are probably some of the most profound philosophical and political arguments in the 20th century. There are very few, well, in fact, there are no other organisations that are robust enough to protect themselves from the press, to protect themselves from the politicians, protect ourselves from outsiders. There are not many. There are structures in both, and I talk about all the 12-step fellowships. Refusal to accept outside contributions is a staggering idea. It's a staggering notion. It evades everybody else. Anonymity is a staggering idea. How many of us have wanted to go around telling everybody, I'm giving up, I'm giving up, I'm giving up, shut up? How many? You know, it's extraordinary. And the robustness of it, it protects itself. It takes care of us. And these things have, even from the very beginning, amazed me. I had a struggle. I had a hard, hard struggle for, I don't think my head stopped for 3 years. I never picked up after that. A joint to try and get my leg over the ex-old lady, that didn't work. I had terrible struggles. When I got back to England, we were finished. I went down the lane one day and her combs were on the floor. And she'd been dancing with this geezer at the party the night before, and I went apeshit. And a friend of mine was a tin miner. We were down in Cornwall at the time. He said, do you love her? And I said, no. He said, well, why are you jealous? Control. That hairstyle. Those new clothes. I fucking hated the fact I couldn't control that woman. I absolutely resented it, and it gave me great fury. But this guy wasn't in any fellowship, just said to me, taught me that. Sounds pompous now, but I was actually beginning to become teachable. Very slowly. Beginning. So I was beginning to stop scoring points. Beginning to not to have to be right. Beginning not to need to control other people. Just beginning. Not succeeding by a long chalk. But at least becoming aware of it. You know, when we hear people say, oh, I don't do that anymore, I've let that go. I don't know whether I ever let things go, but I do certainly recognise. And then eventually maybe they do go. I had two young babies at the time. I'd had a previous family and lost them, and the two young babies, I knew we were splitting up, and I decided in recovery and with help that the most important thing that I could do is to rearrange rather than break this family up, that it would be a rearranged family. It wouldn't be a broken family. I'm a child of a broken family. I've seen children of broken families with that kind of, in that look, those knees pointing in, that look. And I was determined that my children wouldn't be like that. The only time in my life I've put an ounce of effort into a relationship was the effort I put into the way that that relationship split. And it's paid off beyond all measure. They live in the country. I visited them a visit. I always turn up. My mother never did. I always, if I said I'd be there, I'd be there. I was always turned up. I took the old lady to court so that the money I gave her would be taxable. It's a technical thing. And when the magistrates told me how much I paid. And I didn't have much money in this. I said, that's not enough. And I put another fiver on it. You know, what I'm trying to say is I picked up my shit for the first time in my life. I went to the house down the road where she'd moved with the children, and there was a curtain across the room, and sitting on the other side was this guy who'd had her combs out of her hair in the party, and I knew him, and he was a nice bloke, but I looked through and I saw this fucking demon sitting there, this devil. And something happened, good old N.A., you know, something, it goes into us, somehow it goes into us, and a curtain lifted, and I said to myself, step back, now I have another look at him. I took a deep breath and I looked through the curtain. There was this very nice man who I knew, fucking good-looking bastard. Younger, thinner, really nice man, looking scared. So I went through that curtain with the sole purpose that he wouldn't feel frightened of me. And we'd been friends, really good friends. And I went to the wedding, I patted her bum and pushed her down the aisle. Couldn't resist it. But we've remained friends ever since. And time and again, my daughter and my son have said to me, it is amazing that you and Mum are friends, because how you could have ever lived together, I don't know. Because we are different. I met her in a drug deal. I was the addict, you know. But today, I have this extraordinary relationship with my children. This is the real richness for me in recovery. When I came in, I wanted to become a famous film star so I could have endless pussy, endless drugs, and the medical backup. I had this image. In those days, John Lennon's Rolls Royce used to turn up at demos, and there'd be dark windows, so he probably wasn't there, you know. Or if he was inside, I always imagined he'd be in there with all sorts of medicines going into his arm, you know, and lots of doctors looking after his habit. And that's what I thought is what I thought was what I wanted. I thought I wanted. That's the sort of thing I thought I wanted. It's absolute nonsense. I didn't want that at all. You know, what I wanted is what I have now, which is a wonderful, caring, decent relationship with my family. I have an older son in Ireland who's 50, who had a terrible time with booze. His mother was... it's all about family tonight, but his mother was alcoholic, schizophrenic. I married her in New York. You would, wouldn't you? That's what you'd choose. An analyst once said to me, you go into a room full of perfectly normal women, there's one lunatic, everybody's avoiding her, you marry her. And I went to his wedding in Dublin, his second wedding in Dublin just recently. The whole family turned up. And sitting in a wheelchair was a woman who I had been angry about for 40 years. And she was sitting in a wheelchair and her face was pulled down to one side and she'd had a stroke and I looked into her eyes and I burst into tears. Sobs came out of me. Somebody who I'd reckoned I'd hated and hated and hated. I had loved her. And I protected myself from that love because I'd suffered from mental cruelty, which is usually, you know, it wasn't common in the 60s to talk about being abused by a woman. It's usually the other way around. But so I had protected myself from the memory of it by pretending that I just married her for please my mother or something nonsense. It was not true. I poured out with compassion for that wretched woman who has suffered all of her life from serious mental problems, drugs, pills, booze, a wretched time. And one period she was in treatment for a month of sanity, and she sent me a letter saying, "Dear Dudley, I married you to fix me, and when I found you couldn't, I turned on you." And that was tremendous because I'd always, you know, I'd never trusted her. So what I'm saying is that I can trick myself, I can fool myself, I can play games with myself endlessly. But the truth, when it comes out, is overwhelming. And this was overwhelming. All I could do was to get behind her wheelchair and duck her in and around the church so she could always see the bride and groom. And then after that, I left her get to be taken care of by the people who look after her. It lasted a good hour, but it was an extraordinary time. Recently, a very, very close family member, because we're being recorded, I can't identify his relationship or anything, but he has just come out of treatment a couple of weeks, two or three weeks ago. And so I'm back in touch with the disease. It's extraordinary. His mother has been raging. She got the brunt of it. They live in Devon, I live in London. But the one family member who was cool about it all was me. It was cool, just, you know, because we know. We know what's on offer. We know the games. We know the bullshit. We know the stuff. And I don't have to score points. I never said anything to any of them. Any of them. And when they were going on the great source of knowledge, the internet, to learn about addiction, how could they know elsewhere? Or those government subtext games that they play. Still cool. Luckily, 30 years ago, a 12-step guy who runs a treatment centre. and he's been taken care of. Eventually very, very well. And it's wonderful to see the next generation. My oldest son was an addict. He's clean. He's happily married to a really decent woman. My other relatives are clean. My daughter was never an addict. You know. Her mother was not an addict. Addicts in both families, riddled with it. In fact, at this wedding in Dublin, we had people from America. Am I right, Tom?
Yeah.
People from America, from England, from Ireland, all relatives from all over the place. It was like a big plum tree. Some of the plums are ripe, some of them are not ripe, some of them are shriveled, some of them are dropping off. But we're all in process. The young plums got spewing up all over the lift and the older ones are tooting and one's in recovery looking at their watches. It's an extraordinary journey and it is a family illness and it's kind to me if I let it be. How long have I got?
10 or 15 minutes.
Another 10 or 15 minutes. It's true. I think one of the ways that I can describe we're talking to newcomers now, the program of Narcotics Anonymous. It's like when you're on an ocean liner. You go to the pictures, or you go to the restaurant, or you dance, or you have it off with each other in the cabin, or you do whatever you do on ocean liners. And underneath it, somewhere deep down, you can just hear the dull throbbing of the engines. And that, to me, represents the program of recovery of Narcotics Anonymous. It's always there, it's constant, and it's throbbing away, and it's there if I look for it. It doesn't dominate my life in the sense that this is, to me, very much a bridge to normal living. Eventually, when I'm strong enough to fly the nest, in a sense, I get on with my life. I take care of business by... I'm very lucky because I actually like meetings, and I go to meetings and have done for many years and still do. I still need them. I was diagnosed recently with emphysema, so immediately I start smoking. That's an addict. Fucking nuts. So I keep coming back to meetings. It's... What can we say? I mean, Eloise's story is very true. Once you get it, grab it. You know, my son, once he got it, he had to do two lots. I've blown his anonymity now. Anyway, there we are. But he... It's wonderful to see people when they get it. We all know that. Yeah, right. And you stop fighting. But we do fight. it's a killer disease. Oh yeah, this is, yeah, newcomers, you know, we come in, we have this appalling low self-worth. The moment I step through a door, this is me being preachy now, the moment I step through a door and put my backside on a chair in a Narcotics Anonymous meeting, even if it's my first day, I am now in the business of saving human life. That is not something to be to have low self-worth about. That's something to have dignity about. That's something to be proud of. That's something to feel good about. And caring and fill ourselves with love about, love for our fellow human beings. You know, we think it's more important to be a junkie than to be gay. So. It tickles me. I can be both. I'm trisexual, tri drug mule, try anything. One of the exciting times I had, I was going around with a group of people in America, visiting colleges, talking about specific things. And everywhere we'd go, we'd stay in a little motel. And they didn't know about me. And every now and again, these amazing people would turn up at the motel to pick me up on a Thursday night. Some cowboy with a fucking truck down in Texas with a rifle on the back rack coming in, blaring away. Hey, darling, come on, darling. People kept saying, who are these people? My proudest moment was in Charleston, North Carolina. In front of the yard of the hotel come 30 Harleys with these guys with hair, tiger collars, fucking enormous Harleys with the colours on the back of their leather jackets. N.A. Hugs, not drugs. Stay clean, motherfucker. Well, I'm sitting on the back. We're riding through the town. These friends, who the fuck's that? I said, just friends of mine. And these enormous guys, these prisoners on the back, as well as scars, just come out of jail. These big black guys are fucking sitting on the back. Up into the hills to a meeting. Out come the candles, the lights go. Spiritual meeting in Narcotics Anonymous, motherfucker. I was so proud. There's groups of people I could be with, but shit, that was it. That was about as hip as you could be. On the back of a Harley going through town, people freaking looking the other way. Stay clean. Gentlest, kindest people I met, I would have run away from them in terror if I didn't know them. The public conception, the public perception of an addict is so false. The real perception of an addict is a bunch of people in this room this evening sounding cheerful and hopeful, optimistic, caring, giving a damn about each other. It doesn't ask much. All it asks of me is I get well in order to help you get well, not to get myself a Rolls Royce with shaded windows or a career. And it's led me down many paths. I'll be 80 in April, and I live cool and easy. I never thought I'd like to live alone. I love it. I love it. George Burns, the American comedian, said, happiness is a warm, loving, extended family in another city. Thank you. I'd like to thank you there and finish there. Thank you very much.
To tonight's speakers, in NA we celebrate theme time with queuings, claps and hugs. For that, I'm going to hand it back to tonight's sharers.
Anybody